Okay, guys, you ready? Are we ready? We need you to be quiet. Yes, yes. So, to remind you what we're up to, we started learning this topic about Esther in Halacha, or impact of Esther in Halacha. And there is this particular episode that I wanted to study together that will get somehow within the conversation. Esther is going to be introduced. But without any more introduction, let's just read this. The question is posed, just to get some historical context, and I sent you the sources last night, but this is only in Hebrew, so if it helps, it helps. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Okay? The book that I'm reading from is a book which is called Binyan Tzion. It's called Binyan Tzion. The Binyan Tzion was written by somebody named Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. The question was posed to him by somebody else, and the individual that asked the question, his name is Friedlander, Rabbi Mendel Friedlander. When I was searching to try to find out more about this fellow, I actually found the same question posed to other people. You'll see why before I finish today. But part of the problem was how you spelled Friedlander. Some people spelled Friedlander as two different names, like without even a slash, Friedlander, and some is Friedlander, and some is just Friedlander. So the story is like this. I'm going to read, I'll translate, and then we'll begin. Then we'll try to analyze it together. Sheila, question. Hinei ze yamim lo kavir bama aseh lefanai. In these difficult times, a question has come before me. Asher kol shomea, anybody who hears the question, tatzilena shnei oznav, their ears will start to ring. By the way, I actually love the modern Hebrew that this is written in, even though here's a fellow who lived 1798, died every 1871, and you're dealing with somebody who is before Ben Yehuda, before really modern Hebrew. But unless he starts off, whoever hears this question, their ears are going to ring, and he starts to tell us the following story. This Rabbi Friedlander says that in one of the cities that are under my jurisdiction, which means I'm the rabbi of there's a bunch of these little towns around. And by the way, that was the norm. Jews at that point generally did not live in big cities. Generally, they lived in little towns. I don't know if any of you have ever attempted to try to research your own families, where they came from. If you go far enough back, you're going to find that a lot of people lived in these little towns of a population of 200 people, 300 people, and sometimes much, much less. And he says, in one of the towns that was... And by the way, most of these little towns, sometimes it was 20 Jews in a town. So it wasn't like there was even a shul necessarily in them, or certainly not other services. But sometimes you had one rabbi who was the rabbi over a bunch of the little towns in the area. And he says that was the situation over here with this Rabbi Friedlander. And he tells us about how they lived. B'chadak farim omdim tachat galid darim shnei Yehudim. Two Jews live in this area. V'derkam lelech ala mischar mahalach eiz yamim. And what they do is, for business, they need to travel. And v'nishoteim levadam bebayit. And they would end up, their wives would stay home. B'neihim uvenoteim umishareteihim. They would stay home with their kids, sons, daughters, and help. Which is also interesting in terms of understanding a certain socioeconomic level that these people are on. So you're dealing with people who are business people. They have to travel because they're locally there's not enough resources in order to really generate a proper income, so they go off and they do business. And they leave behind their wives and their children and their maids. And he then tells us, and this is what happened. And on a particular day, the husband, father, went off on a business trip. Lemischar, right? The ish echad ba mi medinat Polin ubigadav kruim. So I just need to stop here for a second to understand a little bit more of the background. Because he's saying something, there's some codes over here that we don't necessarily get. Friedlander is a German name. And he just now played off Friedlander versus Poland. So Germany was far more modern, and that these wealthy Jews who live in the little town versus this guy comes from Poland with tattered clothing. So just imagine right now, you have a little bit of a culture clash. You have some old time. Now, just, I don't want to cast aspersions, but for our own needs, let's call it a Hasidic looking dressed guy, but with real, again, old time Jewish clothing. Versus more modern people, but the old-time Jewish-looking guy in Poland has tattered Hasidic type of clothing. And again, I'm saying Hasidic with quotations, that's just in order for us to get the image down. So it says that this guy shows up by the door, v'yivakesh mi'aisha makom lalun. And he asks, he knocks on the door, and the woman answers the door, and this guy, you know, with his tattered clothing, says, I really need a place to stay. So obviously, back in those days, it's not like there's a hotel in the area. It's not like there's any place. And he wants a place to stay. Now, right there, by the way, you have now a, if you want, an ethical dilemma. You have a Jew who's wandering around. He needs a place to stay. And you have a woman whose husband isn't home. Kids are home. Maid is home, whatever. And he wants a place to stay. So right then, if I were to ask you, so what's the appropriate thing to do? So I can force my values upon you. We can debate this. You could tell me, but you need to be nice to Jews. And I can say, but nonetheless, a married woman, it's not appropriate for her to open up her house and take some stranger into the house. By the way, a stranger who you have no idea he is. Only thing you know is that he looks like he's a guy from Poland and he has his tattered clothing. So right there you have this dilemma. But it says that this woman, Vayisha asher hayta tsnua biyoter, I hope you know what that phrase means. Those are not foreign words. And this woman who has always been extremely modest, which means that she is of a certain type of a demeanor, kol yameha, aval yirata kisilta. But her fear of God was greater than her intelligence, in a sense, and she ended up making the wrong conclusion, saying, listen, I have to be nice, there's a stranger over here, you know, what do I do? And it says, Rachma alav, she had compassion on him, v'nana lo makom lalun, and she gave him a place to spend the night, v'gam lecho v'lishtot, and she also gave him food, eat, drink. So essentially you have a very nice Jewish woman, it's actually maybe even a little too nice, who allows a stranger into her house, gives him a place to sleep, gives him food. Amnam, however, ha'oreach, and one of the things I want you to note along the way as the story is presented, how he keeps on changing the terminology of this person. Right now he's the oreach, the guest. It's going to get worse as we continue. He starts off as somebody who, you know, somebody who's in tattered clothing. Now he's the guest. Amnam ha'oreach hu lo achal etzla shum davar min achai. This person refused to eat anything that had been alive, which right then you have to stop and ask yourself, okay, why is not, does he not trust the kashrut? Or maybe there's something else going on. Gam lo shata mashke, rakmayim. And if he used to drink anything, only water. Ukahina asa ma'ase prishut v'siguf atzmo b'sigufim kashim kol hayom yashav b'chedro. Let me go back and explain. But rather, and this is going to be part of the sale over here, or the presentation of who he is, but rather, he acted as a person who has no bodily needs. Maaseh prishut, which means the impression that he's giving that he's some kind of a holy person, some kind of a tzaddik. I don't need to eat anything. I don't need to drink anything. I could subsist upon water. But it continues and it says, and every day he sat down in his room, misugar, locked up, and a book in his hand, and every night until midnight, and afterwards he would say what we know as a prayer called Tikkun Chatzot. He would pray and he would cry at midnight for the destroyed Beit HaMikdash, which, by the way, is a prayer that my suspicion is most of us don't say, but it's a prayer which is a Kabbalistic prayer, which is reflecting the loss in the world, feeling the pain of God, as it were, and crying for the Beit HaMikdash, which is destroyed. And it says that he would do this every single night. By the way, one of the questions you can already start to ask yourself, well, how long is he planning on staying here? I mean, but this is what this tzaddik does. And when he finally went to sleep at night, he did not sleep on a bed, just safsal, or on some kind of a couch. Rather, he lay down on the ground, and he had rocks under his head. And every day he would go out and use the local river as a mikvah. By the way, we're about to learn what time of year it was. It's the middle of the winter, again, someplace which today is either Germany or Austria or that those environs. I can assure you that the water is nice and chilly in a river, you know, that time of year in that type of a location. But nonetheless, part of his being a tzaddik was that he would go and he would be tovel, he would go to the mikvah. Again, these little towns didn't have mikvahot necessarily. He would go and he would immerse himself, b'mayim karim shonahar, pamayim be'et hakor, and sometimes it was extremely cold. Kenahag be'et ha'isha miyom aleph parshat truma. He got there, this would be this coming Sunday, right, in our calendar. He got there from Sunday parshat truma, ad Shabbat kodesh parshat titzaveh, and this is the way that he behaved from Sunday until Friday or Saturday. And meanwhile, the husband's away, he's there, he's praying, and he's crying, and he's learning, and he's not eating anything, and he's this huge tzaddik. Amnam bilel Shabbat, Friday night, achar gmar sudatan, after the meal was over, hatinokim u'mashartei abayit amdu, the children and the servants all got up, kulam me'al ha'shulchan, they all got up from the table. V'holchu lishon l'cheder acheret. They all went to sleep in adjacent rooms. V'ha'ish haramai. So now he just now changed from the oreach to the ramai. Anybody know what a ramai is? Somebody who's deceitful. Somebody's full of deceit. Ramaut is somebody's full of deception. And now the ramai, this deceitful man, odene yosheva l'shulchan ima isha. He's sitting alone now with the woman. Levado, all alone. V'nichnasita b'dvarim. And he starts to speak to her. Until she can no longer contain herself. Ad sheshala oto, till she finally asks, mi ata? Who are you? U'me'ayin tavo, where have you come from? So I need to explain this as well. During those days, and this is a theme which is real, and it's not just in this area, it's lots of places. All over the world we know stories about this. Where great, great tzaddikim would sometimes feel they need to leave their homes, leave their towns. Let's just say, for argument's sake, a rabbi would feel that he gets too much kavod in his own shul, in his own town, in his own place, and you go someplace else where nobody knows who you are. And then people treat you as a bum. People treat you. And the person could say, listen, getting all this kavod is bad for my neshama. And rather, what my neshama really needs is to get beaten up a little bit, be treated as somebody who is a lowlife. So therefore, she's heard these stories, and she sees what kind of tzaddik he is. She sees he doesn't sleep in bed. She sees that he goes and he's tovel in a river. He goes, immerses himself as a mikvah. She sees that he doesn't eat. He cries for the Beit HaMikdash. And she has become somewhat convinced right now that this must be some kind of a very holy man. So she finally asks, who are you? And I'm going to say this again now. I know of stories like this with the Vilna Gaon. I know stories like this with the Baal Shem Tov. Chassidim, Mitnagdim, I know stories about this about the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Ashkenazim, Sfaradim. Which means this kind of an idea of somebody traveling, not knowing who they are, is a well-known theme. Or HaChaim, by the way, is an unbelievable story about him. There was, I'm not going to tell the whole story right now, but essentially the Or HaChaim decided that he was being treated too nicely, and he goes off into Galut, and he gets to this town, and somebody sees him and says, oh, when, you know, who are you? Why don't you come in and eat by me? So Friday night, he comes and eats by him. And he says, listen, in our town, there's a rabbi who's so holy. He knows what they're teaching in Beit Shomala. He knows the Torah they're learning right now in heaven. So the Or HaChaim says, come. Now, before he got to the town, it was Parshat Bichukot, Ta'im Bichukot Elechu. And on Friday, the Or HaChaim came up to 42 different interpretations of Bichukotai Teilechu. So, and he wrote them down on Friday. So Friday night, his host takes him to the rabbi, and the rabbi says that there's a holy rabbi named the Or HaChaim, and he wrote 42 interpretations of Bichukotai Teilechu, and I'll share 14 with you right now. And the guy says, there's a holy rabbi, Or HaChaim Kadosh, right? And the Or HaChaim sitting there, and he says, the Or HaChaim, like he tries to say, like, get rid of any honorific or kadosh and anything. And people got very upset. What kind of guest do you have over here? He's insulting the rabbi. He's insulting the great Or HaChaim. And just let it be said is that the Or HaChaim tried to run away from kavod, and he ends up getting unbelievable kavod, including being revealed that whatever he wrote down is being taught in heaven right then. By the way, the story ends that by the time Shabbat was over, he insulted the Or HaChaim, has insulted the Or HaChaim so much that they tied him up, they locked him up, and they put him in a closet, and they were going to beat him after Shabbat. So meanwhile, right as Shabbat has ended, an unbelievable storm breaks up, thunder and lightning and all kinds of things, and the rabbi then says, I need to find out what's going on, and he faints. And the rabbi, they say, his soul goes up to heaven, and he goes, what's going on? And he goes, all that noise, the thunder, the lightning, it's all happening because Shabbat can't end. And he goes, why can't Shabbat end? He goes, because the Or HaChaim can't say Avdalah. He goes, why can't the Or HaChaim say Avdalah? He says, because he's locked up in your shul. They tied him up. And then they found out that it was really the Or HaChaim, and then they gave him all kinds of kavod. And he says, okay, I can't run away from kavod. And he goes back home. All of that, by the way, is written in the introduction to the Or HaChaim. And it explains why he has 42 interpretations of Imbichukat Telechu. So I'm saying this theme of people feeling that they need to run away because they need too much kavod. By the way, with me, it's the opposite. When I go and I'm a scholar in residence, I get lots of kavod wherever I go. And I get paid lots of money to go and teach in different places when we used to travel. So I don't know. So maybe good. Corona is my punishment. I have to stay home. That's the punishment. So she finally says, who are you? Where have you come from? Va'ana teleich, and where are you going? Va'anala, and he says to her, shlucha d'rachmana ana. Beautiful in Aramaic, what does that mean? Shlucha d'rachmana ana. Well, good. Shlucha d'rachmana ana, I am a messenger of God. Shlucha d'rachmana, of the merciful one. I am an emissary of the merciful one. Shlucha d'rachmana ana. Or if this was the Blues Brothers, yes. I'm on a mission from God. Okay. Those of you who don't know these references have a lot of work to do. So he says, I'm on a mission from God. Ushmi, and my real name is, if you're already asking, and this is like the kind of thing, this is a secret, you know, I can't, don't tell anybody, but Vishmi, and my name is Eliyahu HaNavi. I am Eliyahu. By the way, those of you who don't know, Eliyahu died a long, long time ago. And this person is at this point admitting that he is really Eliyahu HaNavi. And then he continues. And he says, Ve'etachai enochi mivakesh, I'm searching for my brothers, for the Jews. to gather them from all of the exiles, to bring them back to Eretz Yisrael. I'm only allowed to reveal this to people who are very modest. So far, do you like this guy's, or is he working too hard? But then it gets much better. Va'isha l'rov sichlota haemina lo. And this woman, with all of her intelligence and sophistication, believed him. Hilcha lishon al mitata b'cheder esamuch. She went to sleep in her bed in an adjacent room. Va'ha'ocher hanal. We just now went from oreach to ramai to ocher. Ocher is even worse. It's like this leech, as it were. Odenu yoshev al mekomo. He's still sitting by the table. Shabbat table, Friday night, he's sitting. Al mekomo va'ayin b'sefer ad chatzot halayla, and he's learning his sefer until midnight. Ula achar chatzot, and after midnight, amad, he stands up. V'halach la'at al etzpa'ot raglav, and he goes on his tippy toes. Again, I just absolutely love the way that he writes this. It's a terrible story, so I apologize, but I love the way he writes it. He goes on his tippy toes. El hamita asher isha shachva shama. And he goes over, sneaks into the room, to the bed where this woman is lying down. V'hi'ir ota mishnata, and he wakens her up from her slumber. V'yidaber eleha hena, and he says to her the following. And this is his pickup line. And as I said, you all have to agree, no one can use this line. Halachti mikatzeya aretz v'ad katzeya aretz. I've traveled from one end of the world to the other end of the world. V'lo matzati tzadeket kamotech, and I have not found a woman who is as holy and righteous as you are, who is a tzadeket. Asher hi ru'uya latzeit mimena Mashiach, you are worthy of being the mother of the Messiah, being the mother of Mashiach, which means the way that it works in heaven, you really should be giving birth to Mashiach. But there's only one problem. Achamniyahi, but what's holding you back from being the mother of Mashiach? Mitzad ba'alech, your husband is unworthy. What's the matter? You see where this is going. She'eno hagun, he is unworthy. Lekach. Lezot nishlachti min hashamayim, and that's the reason I was sent from heaven. Lishachev otach, to be intimate with you. Uke'et chaya, he says, I swear by my life, till di ben, you will get pregnant, you will have a son, v'huya Mashiach ben David, and he will be the Messiah, the son of David, v'yigal et Yisrael, and he is going to be the Redeemer and save the Jewish people, v'zelach ha'ot, and he says, I'll prove it to you, ki Eliyahu Anochi, that I am in fact Eliyahu. B'yom shlishi haba aleinu l'tova, this coming Tuesday, la'acher hifirdi mi'itach, after I leave, im tiftach at pitach ha'teva asher omed po b'cheder, if you open up the drawer which is in this room, b'cheder mishkavech, in this bedroom, timtza sham otzer matmun rav, you're going to find a treasure, arbar me'ot dukatin shel zahav, 400 gold coins will be in this drawer, but on condition that you don't open up the drawer before Tuesday. Kodiber Eleha Hanoef. So spoke, now his name got changed to Noef, which is an adulterer. So spoke the adulterer. Ad shepita, until he seduced, vitime ota, and defiled her, pa'amayim, twice, bilel Shabbat, on Friday night, ubamotsoi Shabbat, and again on Saturday night, uviyom rishon terem alota shachar, Sunday before the break of day, the dawn, barach hanoef misham, the adulterer ran away from there, v'lo neda mikomo, and nobody has heard anything about him, any idea who he is, where he is. Ve'eshet ksilot hanal, and this silly woman, chasha lichtov lebala, she yeshuv meher lebeito. She sent a letter to her husband saying, come home. Basher hitzliach Hashem et beito b'matmon gadol. Because there's a treasure waiting for them in their house. He doesn't have to work anymore because they have all this gold, which is now in the house. So she sends a letter, come home quick. Va'ish shamayla, and her husband listens and comes home. V'yashav b'yom shlishi, and he comes back on Tuesday. V'tiftacha isha et ateva, and she opens up the drawer. Anybody want to guess what happens? You've heard this story? And she opens up the drawer, and she finds that, in fact, v'lo matza me'uma me'amatmon asher amar hano'if. And she finds nothing, no coins, which the adulterer had told her is there. And when she sees that the man has lied, and now finally, in Israel years ago, we used to have a term for this, ha'asimon nafal, I can't translate this, but it means that now she finally realized that the whole thing was a lie. Uvrataki sheker b'fiv, when she realized now that he had lied, tsa'aka, she screamed, ubachta b'mar nafsha, and she started to, again, literally, like to shake and to cry, v'siprela ba'ala et kol ha'toiva asher asah harasha hazeh, and she told her husband all of the things, inappropriate things, disgusting things that this wicked man had done to her, v'dibra libo, and she spoke to his heart, hello, lo be married uva ma'ala siti zot. She said, I didn't do this to cheat on you. I didn't do this because, you know, I wanted to cheat with this guy. Zot sahadi bimarim, let the heavens be my witness. Kavanati aya l'shem shamayim. I did this because Eliyahu and Avi came and told me that that's what I had to do. V'lanoyef haya ishma'us u'michu'ar. And this man was actually disgusting and ugly. Now you know why he needed a pickup line like this. Ma'od, exceedingly. And what would bring me to want to sleep with a man like this? Amran haba lo shakat b'zeh. He wasn't happy with this. He wasn't still. He was bothered. Rakba elai, and the husband came to me. V'siper li kol advarim. He told me everything. V'sha'al mimeni kedat malasot. And he asked me, what should I do? Imishto. V'shalachti achar isha. I sent for the wife. V'chakarti b'chakirot shonot. And I cross-examined her in various ways. And she told me the same story. And I asked them to separate from one another until I speak to you. And that is basically the question that I was asked. Okay, my young rabbis, did she cheat on her husband or was she raped? Okay, first of all, the only intelligent people here so far have been the guys who have been quiet. To speak is a mistake. But does anybody, I mean, do all of you see the dilemma? You don't even see a dilemma over here. Gnevus Das, okay. Okay, guys, first thing I want to tell you, but by the way, do you agree with me that this was the craziest story you ever heard and you're never going to forget this? You'll forget everything else I taught you this year except for this? Oh, that's going to stay? But okay.
This is also good. That one is also good.
Okay, good. Well, okay. Now, over here, if this were a one-time occurrence, what I mean by this is, no. I mean something else by this. I mean that I've heard multiple times in my life of people who've done similar things. Mostly, this is done by rabbis. There was a case in Jerusalem around 30 years ago. Of somebody who did this. He sold himself off as a Kabbalist. He convinced a bunch of people. He convinced a bunch of women that they should be sleeping with him, that somehow that again, same kind of thing. And there was a case in Tzfat a couple of years ago. The guy, I believe, is sitting in prison, the guy from Tzfat. But the only reason he's sitting in prison, also, why should a person go to prison for such a thing? Again, you can get back to the point. Okay, if it's rape, by the way, that would make it much easier to go to prison. The way they were actually able to arrest the guy in Tzfat was because he was the rabbi of some of these people. So then when somebody's in position of power and misuses the power that they have, that then creates a certain type of an illegal relationship, which means that that's going to be true. Again, there are laws on the books for all kinds of abuse of power, but if it's just some guy on the street, you know, stays by a woman's house and convinces her that he's Elio Navi, it's a little hard to prosecute.
And if they did it multiple times, how could you argue that it's rape? Like, in the story, it doesn't seem like the girl had any, like...
I'm going to say it again. You be quiet. I'm trying to help you here. I know you don't appreciate that. Can anybody argue why it would be rape? Well, part of the problem, what we're really trying to get at, is what is the definition of rape? I mean, part of your mistake is that you think rape is always a violent crime.
No, but, okay. Yes.
One second. That's part of your mistake. Yes? Am I correct? Yes. So now we could just discuss that for a moment. Is that true? Is rape always a violent act or not necessarily? Okay. So that's a problem. I'm not saying rape is not always violent. So, but, what? No, I'm saying, if you're correct that rape is always, it has to be violent, oh, this wasn't violent, so it's not rape. But I just think that your contention is just not true.
Yeah, what did you say that?
You keep on talking. You keep doing this.
No, because listen, her being gullible, she just met this guy. What, are you going to believe that he's Mashiach? And any person?
No. She's about to be pregnant with Mashiach. You missed the story completely.
Okay, well, he said that
well, she didn't come on the one-year program. She doesn't know this yet.
It's not my problem.
It's like paying money. It's like paying money for like a... She let him in the first place because she was trying to be funny. But she's also like...
Yeah. By the way, I don't know the answer to this question. You said he was working, you know, the whole time. Was it true that he was doing this the whole time? That the whole thing was a setup from the day that he walked in? Or is it possible that along the way he said, okay, listen, I can hit on her. She's too innocent. I'm going to... Which means what I'm asking is, does his Yetzer Hara get the best of him at some point? Or this is a setup from the very beginning?
I would assume if he's willing to impersonate Eliyahu HaNavi, and if he's willing to kind of mikvah every day in a freezing cold place.
Maybe that's why he has to go to the mikvah, because he does things like this. No, but it's interesting, because... No, what I'm saying, what it's interesting is that you live... I'm not picking on you, I'm just picking on you. That it's a very... comic book, good, bad, either people are good or either people are bad, and there's no, and by the way, that makes the world very easy. Somebody's completely good or completely bad, but the real world may be much more complicated. See, the case, okay, there's actually what's interesting. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I don't know how to answer this. But what I do think is that this whole situation is really... What I do think is that this situation is really important in terms of a halachic discussion exactly what is rape. If you're right, that rape is only when something is violent, and then it's really easy. Then we have our conclusion over here. And then the conclusion is, this woman is completely... Well, what's the conclusion? It was not rape. She completely agreed, and therefore she's completely guilty. But that's ignoring at least some of the facts over here. Because she does have a defense. What is her defense? Right. So, and again, I want to stress this. The case that happened more recently in Sfat, You know what I'm talking about or no? By all accounts, the rabbi involved in this was a great, great rabbi. Very, very talented, very, very learned, great capabilities. And now I don't know what to say. Again, it's very easy to take, again, your perception. And I said, I'm sorry for picking on you. No, he was always evil, which means this rabbi in Tzfat who I'm talking about. By the way, it's not so hard to do a little bit of research afterwards and just look and scan and you'll find it. That this guy, to say, he only went to yeshiva because he knew that this is a way that he could pick on unsuspecting people. But he ended up picking on wives of students of his. He ended up sleeping with all kinds of people, abusing all kinds of people. But now you have a problem, by the way. If you're able to say that all of those people who gave in to the arguments or of this, again, forget it, this case, all those people that fell for the lines of that particular rabbi, who I'm going to tell you, is a man of great, great capability and great, great charisma and great Torah knowledge, all the people that fell for that, if I can argue they were all raped, then I'm able to save all of those marriages. If I'm saying that all those women were stupid and they never should have slept with somebody other than their husbands, they should have known better, and who cares how smart he is and who cares how capable he is and who cares how charismatic he is, all of that is of no concern right now. So again, the implication of this is going to then be that all of those people are going to end up having to get divorced, and you've just now may have ruined, again, among this yeshiva in Tzfat, you may just now have come to the conclusion that 20, 30, 40 people need to get divorced because of the prodigious talents of this particular rabbi. The case that I talked about earlier in Jerusalem from around 30 years ago, a whole bunch of people ended up getting divorced afterwards. By the way, last year, at this time of year, that's the good thing about being a narcissist, and is that you are very quickly to forgive yourself. A lot of us do something wrong sometimes, and we have a hard time forgiving ourselves. And we need to know that God forgives us. I mean, if you do real tshuva, God actually forgives us. But some people have a really easy time convincing themselves that God convinced them. I mean, I personally would say, if you are a guy who convinced a bunch of women to sleep with you because you were a rabbi, if you've convinced a whole bunch of people that they should be sleeping with you because you're a rabbi, and you misused that privilege that you had, I don't believe you should be getting a second chance. You know, go learn computer, I don't know, programming. You don't have a right now to get up and give enough. There are things, that's why I went back to the case of this woman. One problem was what happened. The other problem was that she let him into the house. And you're right. She did it because she was really nice and she was really kind and she was trying to do the right thing, which is actually part of the issue to begin with. But now we have to try to solve this issue. And again, I want to take it down to one little point. Was she raped or was she not raped? And is rape only something to... Again, let's get that out of the way. I hope everybody here by this point understands that that rape is not only something which is violent. Okay, so let's leave that now on the side. There are going to be various degrees. Over here, and that's why this is so important, over here you're dealing with a case which is emotional rape. Right? That I think is the way to define this. She also said something really interesting in her defense, which we would also need to figure out, is that really important or not? She said, I didn't do this to cheat on my husband. I didn't do this to rebel against my husband. I didn't do this as an act of vengeance or this. I did this because I thought that God had told me that this is really what I need to do. I thought that Eli, I thought a Navi came and told me this is what I need to do. See, well, it depends. Do you believe it or not? Did somebody really speak to you? If nobody spoke to you and you think somebody spoke to you, then you're psychotic and you'll get off. So in a sense, you're taking us back to the argument of the Maharik. What was the Maharik's argument? That was the woman who said, I never learned that law. I'm not allowed to sleep with other people. So what did the Maharik say? Just because there is no... What was the phrase we used? Okay, it was better. We had it better than that. Culpability. Yeah, so he separated between culpability and consequences. He says there's no culpability on her part. She didn't do anything wrong, but there's still consequences. So maybe I can say that's the same case over here. that she cheated on her husband, and that's it. Or may, see, what's interesting about the Binyan Tzion is he really does make the argument for rape. He wants to say it's rape. And by the way, I need to go back a little bit. He wants to say that it's rape because he wants to save the marriage. And I want to start from a backward perspective. When a rabbi is posed a question like this, it's not a simple issue. Is she right or is she wrong? The consequences really are important, which means if I say that she's wrong, and there are consequences. I don't believe so. And the kid wasn't Mashiach. And by the way, all of you who judge her, she could have been somebody's here's great-great-grandmother. So let's calm down a little bit. And who knows how many other women this guy hit on. Good. So I disagree. Because when somebody asks me a question, I do need to take the weight of the consequences in terms of my answer. It does make a difference. It could be, guys, it could be at the end of the day, I need to find truth, and I can't fake truth, but to say that it doesn't make a difference, answer words, it does make a difference. Which means if I can find a path, and I want to go back to that case in Sfat, if I can find a path that I can prevent 30 families from breaking up, that's an important path to take. To just say, listen, who cares? That's it. They're all wrong, and that's it. They shouldn't have believed this guy. The guy's a creep. They shouldn't have believed, and that's it. It's over. No, that's not really the case. I have to deal with consequences of every single decision that I end up giving. That's my responsibility. To say that, just ignore it. I don't think that's... Again, effect is such a funny word. To change the truth, it can't. But, guys, it can't let me change the truth. But what it can do is force me to work a lot harder to try to find a solution. Instead of just saying, listen, this is what it seems to me, and that's it. Hold it. Just because that seems to you, people get divorced? I'm just saying is that you have to take responsibility. And what the Binyan Tzion does over here, and then that's what I think is really interesting, he does want to say that this was a case of rape. And by the way, if what he's saying is true, the consequences are incredible. Because he wants to say, again, I'll try to read a little bit from his conclusion. He starts off and he says, Chazarti al kol tzadim. I've analyzed every single angle on this. V'kashema od limtzot trufa. And it's very hard to find what he calls medication, you know, a way of solving this. To find a way that this woman's saved. And then he right away goes into the case of the Maharik and says, listen, here is a case, a woman did something wrong. She didn't know she was doing something wrong. But there's a major difference in the Maharik's case and this case. The Maharik's case was a woman who's married who doesn't know that you're not allowed to sleep with other people. She just doesn't know them. Or she claims she doesn't know. It doesn't make a difference to me. So therefore, the Maharik says, okay, in such a case, you didn't know. So in terms of God, you don't get any punishment because you didn't know. But in terms of your husband, you cheated on your husband, you have to get divorced. And that was my whole argument that we had about culpability and consequences. There's no culpability, but there's still consequences. So he starts in the Maharik. But it's not the same case as the Maharik. Why? Because in the Maharik's case, she didn't know the law. So over here also, she didn't know the law. But there's one more problem to it. A guy who presents himself as Eliyahu HaNavi comes and tells her, this is what God sent me to tell you that you have to do. So he wasn't Eliyahu HaNavi. And God didn't say. I mean, can you imagine? Good. They're both wrong, but there's a difference in the wrong. The difference is, one, the problem of the second one is that somebody was guilty of manipulation. Somebody came and told you this is what you must do. And she was wrong to believe. But maybe that is itself the act of rape. Which means, again, was this woman raped? And if she was raped, how was she raped? She was raped by this guy telling her that this is what she must do. So again, she's wrong. She thought that's why he sent. She thought that's what she has to do. See, there's another element to all of this. And by the way, so he ends up saying over here, he starts with that argument, but by the time he gets to the end, he brings Esther in. But I want to ask you something. Was Esther right to sleep with Ahasuerus to save the entire Jewish people? She thought she was doing. She thought she was Esther and saving the entire Jewish people because she's going to be the mother of Mashiach. She thought she was Esther. So if you think you could defend Esther, why can't I defend her? So that's what's really interesting about the Binyan Sion. He brings the Esther argument in and says, this is a very similar thing. But if anything, this one's even better because over here she's told that she has to do this. She thinks she's saving the entire Jewish people. The only thing you could say, but she was wrong. But she was wrong. She wasn't saving the people. Look, I want to make this easier. Reb Chaim Brisk, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said, God doesn't expect us to do wrong things to bring good results. If I have to sin, and that's going to bring Mashiach, let's just say argument's sake, I know that in heaven, everything is, you know, one more, the Jews are bad and bad and bad and bad and bad. And if I do one more sin, it's just going to tip the scales and God is going to say, listen, I just got to send Mashiach already because you guys have screwed up so much. So we just need one more sin. Anybody want to volunteer for that one more sin? There you go. You get to choose the sin. Any sin you want is going to bring Mashiach. So Reb Chaim said, no, it doesn't work that way. God does not, and by the way, even if it's true that one more sin will bring Mashiach, he said, who cares about Mashiach? Our obligation in this world to do what's right and to avoid doing what's wrong. And Mashiach coming is God's problem, not my problem. And I have absolutely no ability to be able to break a law, to be able to have a good consequence as afterwards. And the ends don't justify the means. That's what Reb Chaim said over here. So I could just, you know, push this whole thing away and say, no, that's wrong. There was actually, if you know a little bit about it, there was a guy named Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi's whole argument was based upon that we need to we tried long enough to do good, now it's time to do bad. Yeah, now it's time to do bad. We need to do as bad as possible. Mashiach in Gematria is Nachash. In order to bring the Mashiach, you have to act like the Nachash. What did the Nachash do? The Nachash brought sin into the world, so therefore we need to bring more sin into the world. And again, that is a false philosophy. That is something which is alien to Jewish values. But nonetheless, he says over here, again, I'll just read a little bit towards his conclusion. V'hashta b'nidona she'la she'amar la no'ef yimach shemo. There is, by the way, a whole argument. If you ever use the phrase Yimach Shemo, may his name be wiped out, if you ever use it by a Jew, he uses it by this guy. And regarding this fellow, Hanoef Yimach Shemo, Shehu Eliyahu Navi, Shelazot Nishlach Min HaShemayim L'Shakev Yima, V'yemina Ba, and he believed her, Kol Kachad Shekarel Abala, till he find, she believed him so much, she called her husband to come home, because now, all this money, he says, V'ein Lecha Ones Gadol Mizeh. And he says, this is an act of rape. By the way, that's why I think that this is so important, especially in the modern discussion about sex under duress or so on. He says, this was an act of rape. So the Binyan Sion, in this line, went further than anybody else went, as far as I know. But he then says, nonetheless, and he goes, and she thought she was doing the right thing. She's wrong. But this was an act of rape. And he ends at the very well, I think she can stay with her husband because I think she was raped. But he says, I don't want to give the ruling by myself. Take my, you know, decision. If you get two other big rabbis to agree with me, then we'll all three will sign off on this. And I don't know how the story ends. I do know of two other rabbis who dealt with it. One said, absolutely not. She did the wrong thing. It's like the case of the Marik. They have to get divorced. It doesn't make a difference what she believes. She was wrong. And then there was another person who dealt with this, where he says that for a whole different reason, that she can stay with her husband, for a whole different reason, and one which I'll mention briefly, but I said this earlier in the year. I don't know how much it sunk in. There's a difference between halachic truth versus historical events. You would like to believe that that's the same, that something that happened historically, therefore it happened halachically. That's not always the case. Years ago, and I'm talking about a case now of over 30 years ago, a young woman came over to me, something which I'm sure you've heard many, many cases like. She came over and she said a bunch of kids were fooling around and some guy gave her some kind of ring or something and said, Harei at mekudeshetli. Right, and she was laughing and she took it. So are they married now? So she told me this. So I went and I brought her to a rabbi who was far older and more established than I. And I started to tell the story, and he said, leave the room. Right? So she stayed, and he told her the rest. So afterwards, he asked me, he goes, were you upset when I told you to leave? I said, no. You didn't want her to say this in front of two witnesses. Saying something in front of two witnesses is not the same as saying something in front of one person. Part of this, part of the issue over here, by the way, getting married, do you need witnesses? You need witnesses. Were there witnesses at the time? Were they kosher witnesses? Were people keep Shabbat? Which means just because somebody hands somebody a ring doesn't necessarily mean they're married. You need lots of other things in order to create truth. There's actually a Mishnah at the end of Gittin. One of the commentaries here, the Yad Eliezer, quotes this, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. There's a Mishnah at the end of Gittin. What if a woman says to her husband, oh, by the way, I cheated on you. We have to get divorced. So now she could be saying this for one of two reasons. One is she feels really guilty and she wants him to know the truth. And the other is she can't stand him. And she wants a get. And she'll go, oh, listen, I've been cheating on you. Sorry, we have to get divorced. So what does the Mishnah get in, end up saying? Bring proof. Bring evidence. Why am I don't believe you. If he says, I don't believe you, they stay married. Which means the belief over here is actually an important element in all of this. Over here, one, this Yad Eliezer ends up making this whole argument. He says, okay, so she said this is what happened. Why do we believe her? There's no evidence to all of this. And then he plays a little bit what actually happened in the case. But he tries to get to a situation that they don't have to get divorced for a technical reason completely. Okay, she said this is what happened. Now, by the way, part of all of this will depend on did he believe or did he not believe. That's also going to be a part of it. But I'm just saying is that there's this whole other path that we didn't necessarily anticipate. But what was really interesting to me is at the very end of the day, in this case, which is really a sick and twisted case, by the end of the discussion, Esther is right back over there in the discussion. If you take the argument that Mordechai, like the Noda Behuda took, Mordechai told Esther, this is the right thing to do, so then what difference do I have if Mordechai tells Esther, or if Eliyahu Navi tells this woman, but you're going to tell me, but it wasn't really Eliyahu Navi, yeah, so how does she know? So one second. So how does she know that it's not really Eliyahu Navi? She thought Eliyahu Navi told her that this is going to bring Mashiach, it's going to save the entire Jewish people, so she thinks she did something which is right.
But wasn't Mordechai the rabbi of the whole Jewish community?
She thinks Eliyahu Navi, which means, do I analyze things based upon reality, or do I analyze things based upon perspective? If her perspective is that Eliyahu Navi told her this is what she must do, so therefore, that's, again, that in the Binyan Sion, that is the act of rape. Because he told her something that she thought she had to do. So therefore, as far as he's concerned, she was raped in this case, and it's not the same as the Maharik, and therefore, because the sex took place under rape, so therefore she can end up staying with her husband. But again, my point is that this whole Esther discussion ends up coming up in all kinds of cases later on, places that you wouldn't even suspect, you know, when you start this whole story. And as I said, the tragic part of this is that there are sick people who have used arguments like this or claims like this, or I'll say charisma or lies. Essentially, people will use all kinds of lies to get somebody into bed. And how do you deal with these cases? This is an important decision because ultimately, if the rabbis who dealt with that case in Tzfat used this, and I believe they did, they were able to save a whole bunch of people from getting divorced because they said, listen, this man was a rapist. This man raped all of these people by telling them that they must sleep with them and he's fixing their souls, whatever pickup lines that he used. So bottom line is, God is not going to send Eliyahu to any of you and to sleep with you. That's not the way that it works. I'm not going to say that none of you could be the mother or the father of Mashiach, but that's not the way that it's going to work, that somebody's going to tell you that you need to do something illicit in order to create something which is good. That's not the way that it's going to work. And yes, this becomes yet another argument for education, but as I said, the you don't have to agree with the Binyan Sion over here. You just have to understand what his argument is, and his argument was, I think it took a lot of guts, although it was also interesting that he wasn't willing to do it by himself. He wanted to try to get other people to agree, and as I said, I don't know how the story ends. We have questions? Okay, so you get to text me and tell me what you found interesting today.